Swiss watches are cool. When you arrive in Geneva, there are signs everywhere for these incredibly high-end Swiss watchmaking companies. You've seen them. Rolex, Omega, Breitling, and Tag Heuer, just to name a few. Then you see the advertisements and billboards with all the celebrities wearing those fancy, highly crafted Swiss timepieces. Charlize Theron, Kate Blanchett, and Serena Williams all sport them. Oh look, there's Brad Pitt, Roger Federer, George Clooney, and even James Bond. The Swiss watchmaking industry has a long, long history, like 500 years worth of history. But in the 1970s, the Swiss watch industry was nearly wiped out. Almost overnight, tens of thousands of workers in Switzerland suddenly lost their jobs. The period is often referred to as Switzerland's quartz crisis. In this episode, we are going to tell the story of the Swiss watch industry, the trade and technology shock that created the 1970s quartz crisis, and what today's policymakers can learn from that Swiss crisis for workers and for industrial policy. To do all that, I will be joined by a very special guest.
Tate Twynham at the College of William and Mary.
Tate Twynham is an economics professor at the College of William and Mary. Tate is going to share some new research describing the impact on Swiss workers of a massive change to the watchmaking world. Hi, Tate.
Hi, Chad.
You are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade and policy. I'm your host, Chad Bown, the Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Tate, let's start with the very basics. What is a mechanical watch?
A mechanical watch is basically telling time through a collection of gears and springs. These will oscillate, driving gears, driving hands, which will keep track of time, and this has to be regulated in a precise manner. These watches typically involve on the order of 100 or more components for each timepiece.
Tell us about the history of the mechanical watch industry in Switzerland and how it got started.
So the mechanical watch industry in Switzerland is typically dated back to the 16th century. So Geneva was a major hub of global trade with connections all over the world. It also had a great deal of precious metal workers, jewelers who could make very high-end watches that were greatly in demand by the very wealthy. Many of France's greatest watchmakers were Protestant and fled persecution and settled across the border in Geneva. It was also the case that a number of laws were passed in Geneva. John Calvin issued these edicts banning the wearing of ostentatious jewelry, as it was contrary to the Calvinist ethic. But there was an exception made for watches, as these were practical devices. And so this created a great opportunity for watchmakers, because there were many underemployed jewelers, precious metal workers, who could simply transition to making these high-end watches. And so the watch industry grew a great deal in Geneva, and demand for these high-end watches skyrocketed.
Geneva back then was a fairly sizable city. So why did watchmaking begin to expand outside of Geneva?
To protect their industry, watchmakers in Geneva started to form guilds to restrict supply. The high demand for these high-end watches meant that prices started skyrocketing, and there was basically just not enough supply. And so to get around the limitations on sourcing parts, the watchmakers in Geneva started to look to places where they could get components that were not protected by the guild, namely outside of Geneva. Adjacent to Geneva, following historic trade routes, was the Jura Mountain Arc. The Jura Mountain Arc was primarily agricultural, with some textile workers, but the area was mountainous and not very good for farming, and so farming was very seasonal, the weather was very harsh, it was a lot of sort of dairy farming, things like that. So you end up with lots of underemployed farmers living in these mountains. And while the construction of these high-end mechanical watch movements is very skill-intensive, the production of components for them is not. This can be done by relatively unskilled workers. And so a lot of these farmers were essentially recruited into home production of watch components. And this worked out very well because the entire family could take part in this. This was not male-coded work. In fact, half the watch workforce has typically been women. This allowed for a big expansion of home production of watch components throughout the Jura Mountain arc.
How important was watchmaking to these towns and cities sprinkled throughout the Jura Mountain arc in that part of Switzerland?
Many of the cities and towns that started hosting these watchmaking clusters became very large hubs of watchmaking locally. It was a huge part of the commercial enterprise of the city. Some of these cities like Neuchâtel, Saint-Imier, and Le Chaux-de-Fonds started developing larger watch workshops outside of just the family mold. Le Chaux-de-Fonds was referred to by Karl Marx in his work Capital as a giant watch manufactory.
What was it like to be a watch worker in Switzerland at this time?
The production of each of these individual components can typically be done by lower-skilled workers. The assembly of these require much higher-skilled workers. The production of watches was extremely decentralized. Typically, households would often focus on producing a single type of component, and so 100 different households might be involved in the production of a single timepiece.
How did the Swiss industry change during the first half of the 20th century?
At the end of the Second World War, Switzerland was in a great position to exert its dominance over the world market. It already controlled half of that world market, and many of its competitors, France, Germany, had been devastated by World War II, but likewise with the UK. So exports from Switzerland increased dramatically through the 50s and 60s, and the Swiss watch industry became basically the preeminent globally. By the 60s and 70s, the Swiss production model had changed from the 1800s. You had more sort of medium-sized firms and a few large sort of mega firms, such as Rolex and Omega. But for the most part, it was still generally concentrated in small and medium enterprises on the order of, say, on average, 55 workers per establishment. And there were around 1,600 watchmaking enterprises in Switzerland at this time. The Swiss have been partly inspired by the Americans to engage in more mechanization, larger enterprises, but there were pushback along several lines. Many of the watchmaking firms were family-owned, and the family wanted to keep them in the family, and this meant smaller establishments generally, resisting being absorbed into larger enterprises.
What was the Swiss government's industrial policy during this period? What did it do to keep these watchmaking companies both small and located in these rural areas in the Jura Mountains?
The Swiss government had an interest in keeping the watch industry relatively decentralized and spread out throughout the Jura Mountains. The watch industry represented basically a substantial component of these local economies, and so there was a concern that the centralization of these establishments in big firms in large cities would lead to economic decline and political instability in these more rural areas. There was also a concern that a large amount of concentration of industrial workers in big cities would increase the power of trade unions, and this would naturally lead to communism. The Swiss federal government supported the watchmaking groups in the formation of a cartel to prevent too much centralization and too much competition, and also to prevent too much outsourcing of production of watch components abroad. There was a big interest in keeping the production of watch components within Switzerland to avoid economic decline in these various regions. The government's actions and the actions of the watchmaking cartel did help preserve the small and medium enterprise character of the industry and allowed lots of family-run firms to thrive. This, for the time, helped the political and economic stabilities of these rural areas, prevented excessive amount of trade union activity. It also generated a class of family capitalists who were invested in the system. The problem with all of this being that it left these rural areas overly exposed to this one particular industry and with a general lack of economic diversification. This, it turns out, would later make them extremely vulnerable to a large competition shock in the future.
That's the state of the Swiss watchmaking industry by the 1960s and early 1970s. Let's turn to the Swiss watches themselves. At this time, what was happening to the prices and quality of Swiss watches?
The way to think about watches during this time period is they were expensive consumer durables, so not something that you would buy every day. So you could imagine buying something like a Rolex Submariner for on the order of $4,000 in today's dollars. At the end of the day, these are very tiny components that have to be manufactured on a very micro scale. And if you want the watch to do anything more complicated, act as a stopwatch, keep track of the date, have an alarm, this added additional layers and additional components that have to be put together on an extremely micro scale. And even a very high-end watch is going to lose accuracy on a daily basis on an order of 2 to 3 seconds a day. A lower cost mechanical watch that still costs perhaps over $100 might lose as much as 30 seconds of accuracy a day. If there's a way to keep more accurate track of time, and you can do so at a fraction of the cost, there's going to be a market for that.
What was the big technology shock for the watch industry?
The big technology shock to this field was the invention of the quartz watch movement in the 1960s. A quartz watch movement takes advantage of the quartz crystal's property that it will oscillate with a certain frequency if subjected to an electric current. And this frequency can be used to keep track of time far more accurately than a mechanical watch. And a quartz watch movement just requires this crystal, this electricity, and it can be produced at a fraction of the cost of even a low-quality mechanical movement.
Who was able to adopt this new quartz technology?
A number of researchers at Swiss watch companies, but also Japanese watch companies, had looked into various ways of producing electronic watches. Both had settled on quartz as being a valuable alternative. A number of companies in Japan that had already been producing mechanical watches, Citizen, Seiko, Orient, decided to embrace this new quartz technology, but they were able to do so at a mass scale because they had already created much more centralized production operations than the Swiss firms had. In 1969, Seiko released the Astron. This was the first production quartz wristwatch. It was not a budget watch. It was worth about the price of a new car at the time. But due to their more centralized manufacturing system, they were able to scale up production of quartz watches very quickly. Prices for quartz watches dropped dramatically. And by the mid-1970s, one could be had for an order of magnitude less than a comparable Swiss watch.
Quartz watchmakers in Japan especially figure out how to manufacture these new watches at low costs, and they could sell them at much lower prices than the highly crafted mechanical Swiss watches. How did the other attributes of the quartz watch compare with those mechanical watches?
These quartz movements were very robust to shocks, things like that. It was very easy to waterproof them. They were relied on a battery, which had to be changed every couple of years. But aside from that, they were much more robust than your typical mechanical watch. Quartz watch movement was also easily adapted to include other functions. The advent of liquid crystal displays and LEDs allowed for screens that could illustrate all sorts of different information: alarm settings, date functions, chronograph, stopwatch functions. This was now possible with these quartz movements. And these sorts of complications could be added with very minimal cost, whereas adding similar types of complications to mechanical watches increased the cost greatly. Semiconductors basically allowed for these watches to mimic the many possible functions of very high-end Swiss watches, but at a fraction of the cost.
I remember as a kid when I got my first watch, so this was the early 1980s, I think it was a Casio Digital. It had an alarm, and it also played show tunes. So it had songs from Hello Dolly and The Music Man on it. I think it was my Christmas present that year. The upshot is, once we moved beyond these mechanical watches, this 1970s technology was pretty exciting. Okay, what happened in Switzerland?
The quartz revolution had basically turned watches into a low-cost commodity, and this was a disaster in Switzerland. In Switzerland, this is referred to as the quartz crisis. Swiss firms were basically very ill-adapted to respond to this big technological shock. The Swiss industry, being still highly decentralized, did not have the ability to rapidly mass manufacture these new watches. It was also the case that these new watches were not very profitable to sell on account of just their widespread competition from lower wage nations. And so there was essentially no way for Switzerland to compete on a price basis with Japan and Hong Kong. Watch exports from Switzerland to the rest of the world peaked in 1974, and a decade later, they had fallen by half. At the same time, exports of watches to the rest of the world from Japan had skyrocketed to closer to 140 million units versus the 20 to 30 million in the mid-70s.
How did the Swiss industry respond?
The immediate impact on the Swiss watch industry was fairly devastating. About half of the Swiss establishments closed, and employment fell dramatically. The consolidation that the watch industry had avoided in previous decades finally had to happen. Some of the largest watchmaking companies, like Omega and Longines, came together under the umbrella of the Swatch Group. The way they avoided the problems that plagued the industry is they tried to sell this watch as a premium product. So they were essentially selling a low-cost quartz watch, but at a premium, because you could call it a Swiss watch.
How did the Swiss companies change their business model to pivot toward this premium product?
For the Swiss companies that were going to adapt and survive this crisis, the business model had to change dramatically. They're basically selling a functionally obsolete product now, and they could not compete on cost, and they could not compete on accuracy. So in order to have a mechanical watch still deliver something of value, it had to represent something else. The move for these brands was to pivot to upmarket. Rather than representing a tool, a watch is now going to represent status. So for example, the Rolex Day-Date, this is not a watch you buy if you just want a good, accurate watch. It's a watch you buy because it's the president's watch ever since Lyndon Johnson wore it, and it's made of solid gold. And you've seen it on plenty of movie stars, plenty of celebrities. You don't buy an Omega Speedmaster because you want a nice watch. You buy it because it was the first watch worn on the moon. This sort of thing is common to many industries affected by trade shocks. Oftentimes, facing lower-cost competitors from abroad, manufacturing functions of a firm will be outsourced to lower-cost countries, whereas the firms will retain in higher-wage countries things like marketing, operations, and distribution, and so on.
How did the Swiss government change its policy to try to keep some of these watchmaking companies competitive?
Historically, a watch made in Switzerland would be just that. It would be made in Switzerland. However, eventually, the rules were changed by the government to allow for a broader definition of Swiss made. Swiss made now means if 60% of the value associated with a watch is produced in Switzerland, and if the final assembly of the watch occurs in Switzerland, then that watch can be called Swiss made. However, productions of things like bracelets, dials, crystals, and so on can occur in many different countries, and these components can just be imported to Switzerland.
The Swiss government is now allowing imports of components. That's the first thing. Second, Switzerland now has this massive decrease in demand for its watches globally because of the new competition from Japan and Hong Kong of these new quartz watches. How did all of that impact the workers in the Swiss watchmaking industry?
In the short run, employment in the industry dropped dramatically on the order of 60,000 people, or roughly two-thirds. The shift towards more centralized production and the increase in imports of watch components from abroad led to a substantial change in the employment makeup of the industry in Switzerland. Industrial workers fell by half and home workers by 80%. Most of the managerial workforce was retained. They were now responsible for marketing, branding, sales, and distribution, and all of these core functions needed to remain in Switzerland. Nominal wage growth in the Swiss watch industry had previously tracked nominal wage growth across all manufacturing sectors in Switzerland. This decoupled after the onset of the crisis, and wages declined in the industry.
This is such an incredible story. But all of this is really just a background for your research, which is to look at the impact on those Swiss workers in the 1970s. Tens of thousands of people lost their jobs very quickly. This was a pretty concentrated shock geographically, in the Jura region of Switzerland. What happened to all those workers?
Many of them just packed up and left. There was an unprecedented decline in population across these cities and towns specializing in watchmaking. They on average lost around 8% of their populations between 1970 and 1980, and a decline that large had not been seen in the previous 100 years. So there's pretty clear evidence that these workers migrated en masse. Migration response, usually pretty negligible. And so the big question here is, why is the Swiss case so different?
Why was the Swiss case so different? In other contexts, workers often don't leave their communities when their jobs are suddenly lost due to a new technology or because of trade. For the example of Swiss watch workers, what potential explanations do you look into?
There are many possible explanations for why this case might have been different. Two that I focus on most closely are the characteristics of the workforce. Are these the kinds of people that we would expect to be able to easily move? And also the characteristics of these cities themselves in terms of how many other opportunities they might present besides watchmaking. If this is the only game in town, then you can see why it might make a lot more sense to just leave town.
Let's start with the workforce. What are some of the characteristics of those Swiss watch workers that might have made it easier for them to move to new cities and new jobs?
Homeownership is a big attachment to place. Homeowners are much less likely to move. It's also the case that homeowners in an area that is declining in population have a much more difficult time moving. So if you own a home in a city and a bunch of people are moving out, that's a big negative demand shock for housing. But because housing is durable, the impact of that negative demand shock is going to go 100% through the price channel. Those houses aren't going to disappear. They're just going to fall dramatically in price. This can have the effect of locking people in place. But Switzerland doesn't have a lot of homeowners. The homeownership rate in Switzerland is quite low. Things like age can affect the cost of moving. Older folks are going to have possibly more established networks and higher mobility costs. Younger folks have a much easier time adapting to a new environment. A large fraction of the Swiss watchmaking workforce were younger people, and they were substantially more likely to relocate. Education also matters. If you're more educated, you might have an easier time relocating for better employment prospects, and that is also the case for the Swiss watchmaking workforce.
The Swiss workers in the watchmaking industry just had a lot of characteristics that would make it easier for them to move. You also said that you looked at the industrial concentration of these watchmaking cities and towns. How diversified were they? Were there jobs available in other manufacturing sectors nearby? What did you find?
Looking at concentration within the industrial sector, what we see is that in these watchmaking cantons, particularly Jura and Neuchâtel, the main watchmaking cantons, levels of concentration in watchmaking specifically were extremely high. The cantons that specialized most in manufacturing and in particular watchmaking were the ones that ended up losing the most workers over the course of this crisis. If you're going to survive a trade shock like this, you need there to be other opportunities, other sectors to absorb these displaced workers. Many of these cities and towns had initially grown basically centered around watchmaking. And if that was still basically the major industrial sector and the alternative was becoming a dairy farmer, there might not be much appeal to remaining in these cities and towns.
Swiss watch workers also moved because there were few other local opportunities. Now, stepping back from your research, there are other potential explanations for why the Swiss quartz crisis was just different from some other trade shocks that researchers have studied where they found workers didn't move. Can you talk us through some of those differences?
The quartz crisis is an unusual one, and it differs markedly from some of the trade shocks that have been most talked about. If you think about something like the China shock, we get a big rise in imports to the U.S. from China. This is going to hurt a lot of U.S. companies that are now facing more competition. But there's two ways it's going to help a lot of U.S. companies. One, some of these U.S. companies might be using intermediate inputs that they can now source more cheaply from China, And so they're going to become more efficient, more profitable. Two, there's also going to be firms that now have a much bigger export market due to a decline in Chinese trade barriers. The firms that benefit from this rise in trade with China can now potentially absorb workers who have been laid off from other firms that suffered from import competition. In Switzerland, there was none of that. The quartz crisis did not create any opportunities. It only created losers, basically. Given the lack of existing alternative opportunities and the fact that the quartz crisis did not generate any new opportunities for those workers who were displaced from watchmaking, there was basically no choice but to leave. And that's exactly what they did.
From the perspective of the workers, it's important for policymakers to know whether they are confronting something like a China shock or a Swiss quartz shock. Knowing that helps policymakers identify the best way to assist workers. Are there local opportunities if the workers can just be retrained to take up a new job? Or are there no local opportunities, so what workers really need is mobility assistance to get them out of their mortgage and into a new city where there will be new opportunities? Tate, as my last question, I wanted to go back to Switzerland's earlier industrial policy of the mid-20th century that seemed designed to keep these manufacturing companies small and rural. Are there lessons to be learned from the quartz crisis for those policies?
Taking a longer view, knowing what the response will be to something like the quartz crisis can tell us what kind of policies governments should be pursuing in terms of promoting industrial diversification and resilience. Historically, policies in Switzerland were used to promote a decentralized, small-scale watchmaking industry in these rural areas that didn't have much else going on. In the short run, this was great because it provided manufacturing employment. In the long run, it created a vulnerability because there was no industrial diversification to fall back on if watchmaking fell through. So I think an upshot of my results here is that economic diversity is strength.
Tate, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And that is all for Trade Talks. A huge thanks to Tate Twynham at the College of William and Mary. Do check out Tate's new research paper titled Trade Competition and Migration: Evidence from the Quartz Crisis. I will post a link to his article, recently published in the Journal of International Economics, on the episode page of the Trade Talks website. And by the way, if any of those Swiss watch companies that still exist are looking to sponsor a Trade Nerd podcast, I mean, I have had my eye on one of those diver's watches from Jaeger-LeCoultre, maybe a Vacheron Constantin. Thanks to Melina Kalb, our supervising producer. Thanks to Sarah Tu on digital. As always, thanks to Colin Warren, our audio guy. Do follow us on Twitter or Mastodon. We're on @trade_talks. That's not one but two underscores, @trade_talks. Because when it comes to Swiss watches, two would be better than one.